Good afternoon, everybody. Call the Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February the 4th. It's 1:31, and members present, Representative Munoz, Representative Costello, Representative Osterman, Representative Wilson, and Representative Thompson. I expect other members to come and join us very shortly. We have continuing with our department overviews today. We have the University of Alaska, and they will be followed by the Department of Administration. Representative Guerra has joined us. So with that, I think we're just going to go ahead and jump right into it with the university. If President of the University, Mr. Gamble, you want to come join us at the table there and bring up whatever your backup is to carry you through the process. And then introduce yourself and your staff, and we will not take, or I do not allow questions until we get through with your presentation so that we actually get through it, and then we'll get into questions. That's that. Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Gamble, and I'm the president of the University of Alaska System. We have with us today in the audience Regent O'Neill from our Board of Regents. We're glad to have Regents attend these sessions, and they're very busy people, and rarely do we get one, and so it's really good to have one with us. But not only do we have one, but we have two. We have our student regent, Regent Courtney Enright, who will be getting her confirmation hearing tomorrow. And then since she is a student, you might notice a few of her friends in the audience. You know, in the shared governance business of getting approval for the things that we do in the university, one of the recognized bodies that has an input on decision making is the student body. And we have representatives from the student body across the system with us here today, and they're here joining us for the hearings as well, and we want to welcome them. And of course, my partner in crime, Michelle Rizik, who is the director of our budget, is here today to also be available to not only speak as one of the authors of this budget, but also answer detailed questions if we get into any particular issue that goes beyond my level of expertise. I run pretty shallow and pretty wide, and Michelle can get into the real detailed stuff, and if neither one of us can provide an answer, we'll take it for the record and get you the answer right away. The briefing that you're going to see today is not a very long briefing. I think we're all in this game together looking for the right amount of dollars to allow us to go forward productively, but allow us to go forward efficiently given the state of play of the economy of the state of Alaska and what money is available for the state's budget. And we're very conscious of that. We started 2 years ago flattening our budget. We had the advice that times were going to be tougher and that we needed to start thinking about how we were going to reduce our budget. And I can tell you today, I was looking at some numbers that in 2013, the programs, and what I call programs are those things that are the academic programs, sort of the heart of our budget, not paying benefits, not state supported research increments, but the academic programs. We brought an increase in of 1.8% in 13. In 14, this year, it was a 1.7% increase over the previous year. And in the proposal that we brought forward a 0.9% increase for 15. So I'm pretty solid in my declaration that we understand what a flat budget is, and the guidance we got for the last 2 years was to bring in a flat budget, and it was pretty flat. And as a result, we've begun to understand the kinds of things that we have to do to bring in a flat budget, to be able to sustain programs. You all gave us the opportunity with a single appropriation to be able to move money internally to put dollars in the appropriate areas where we needed them, and if if we were going to make priorities, other areas didn't get quite so much. There's been a lot of internal work. And there's been a lot of work with regard to a recognition of what has come out of this committee. For the 3 years that I've been here before you testifying, there have been any number of recommendations and suggestions or questions generally of the nature of, why don't you guys do it this way? Why do you all do it different? Why are the three universities different doing this or doing that or transferring credits and so on and so forth? You're not the only ones that have asked those questions. The board asked those questions. And then finally, I think you're going to see for the first real time, we've asked those questions and we're starting to answer those questions. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. But in terms of the budget itself that you're going to see, it's not much of a budget. Essentially, what we're looking at that is before you, the governor's budget proposal pays for pay and benefits. We pick up the 50-50. Previously, it was 60-40. Now it's 50-50. We pick up that 50%. And so we're trying to bring in contractual obligations and pay raises as tight as we can get them, and we've been bringing those in at levels lower than we've seen in many, many years in the system. So we've been fairly successful at that, and that's a recognition on the part of all our employees that they're in this along with everybody else, and we appreciate that. The only item really in the budget is an item that's really kind of a cleanup administrative item from last year. Otherwise, there isn't a program budget. It really falls upon us to take the money that we've got. These are increments now, so we're getting funding. We're getting good funding because you've given it to us in the past. But we've got to level those program expenses off. And we've got to do that with the idea that we've got those contractual obligations of which we have to pay half, and the size of that personnel account is such that even a 1% or 2% increase are millions of dollars to us. So internally, we've got to find that money, and that impacts programs too. And we're prepared to do that in this particular budget. My principal concern with the budget, I really think, is going to be 16, 17, or where the state is going with regard to the ramp down that we're going to see not only in 15 started, but in 16 and 17, because if we've been flat for 2 years, it means we've done a lot internally to hold on to the expenses. In 15, of course, the starting point was a 14.9 decrement from 14 budget, $14.9 million decrement from the 14 budget. That's the first real cut in the university's budget. We can't really pin down the last time we ever had a cut of that size, probably back to the 80s. But we're in there, and we've told OMB we can handle this. But handling that year after year after year is what's of a concern, because as we wring the efficiencies out of the organization for 15, there's less of an opportunity in 16 and far less of an opportunity in 17. So we're really, and my job is to try to forecast the future. So myself and the chancellors, we're looking forward. We're going to deal with this, but we're looking forward and trying to figure out where do we go next and make sure that the entire university system understands very clearly what that means. With that as an introduction, I'd like to run through a couple of charts very quickly and then turn it over to Michelle for a couple of more, and then we'll open it up to questions and comments, Mr. Chair. For any new members, we always show the mission slide. We always show the facilities, campus locations all across Alaska. This is a fixed cost, a fixed plant, if you will. Operating all these facilities, but it offers, you know, many of our potential students all across Alaska an opportunity to actually work out of a campus. The thing that's changed now, though, is that e-learning and the ability to gain bandwidth in Alaska is changing basically the overall picture of this. And one of the things for the future is deciding how it's going to change with regard to the need for a fixed plant, and that goes for the major campuses as well as for our rural campuses. The big difference this year is what we call shaping Alaska's future. It has been in the budget for the last 2 years in terms of the categories that we've used. This is year number three in this overall look internally at how we do business in the university. But what's different this year is we've finally in our methodology reached the point where we have in draft now and have run past the board, through the faculty, through the students, through the staff, and what we have is a polished draft now of 22 issues that comprise what we're looking at academically, services, facilities across the university system in Alaska. And of those 22 issues, there are what we call 22 effects that we would like to create as outcomes regarding those issues. So if you bundle these 22 effects all together, in there are the answers to the questions, why do you do things the way you do it? Where we've addressed those questions, and the prospects for change are better than they've ever been before, or in fact are in motion and are already being changed. So the Shaping Alaska's Future is very, very important. You can read these charts, and I'm not going to talk to every line on the chart, but I would say that the difference here in terms of the Shaping Alaska's Future and in terms of the budget is the implementation of some of these outcomes. And they don't all mean that we have to come in and ask for more people and more money. These are internal things that we would do anyway to a large degree. But the difference in the past, I think, is that trying to get a decision out of the system with three independent universities and all the independent campuses that work with them was almost impossible in the past. And so things were kicked down the road or declared too hard to do. We now have what we call a summit team that consists of the chancellors of the three universities, the provosts of the three universities, the vice president for academic affairs, who's my principal academic advisor and partner, and then myself. And we are now meeting for the specific purpose of making decisions that affect the system. And the cooperation and collaboration among this group, and I'm mostly talking about the chancellors and the provosts, in my view has never been better, not only in the time that I've been here, but probably for years. And so the opportunity to sit down around the table and look objectively at something that needs to be done across the system and actually making a decision on it and getting it done is not just something we want to do. It's something that's occurring right now. And we've taken a whole list of some of these decisions forward to the faculty, to the staff, to the board. And it's sort of inoculating the entire system with the idea that those 22 effects that we would like to achieve coming out of Shaping Alaska's Future, which is the new foundation for the university for the future, they have to have decisions made. You can't just have committee meetings talking about this stuff. You've got to decide, and then you've got to implement. Well, this group is in the decision-making mode, and every time we meet, more issues come forward, and more issues are put up for decision, and more decisions, the intent to go forward is being expressed. Now, we use governance, which means that we don't ram this down anybody's throat, but the difference is we express intent to go forward and do this. Now, you tell us how you think the best way might be that we should do this, considering academic issues, considering staff issues, considering student service issues, and so on. This is a major change. This is a sea state change from even last year when I talked to you, as we were 2 years into this process, and now we're three. And this is pretty exciting stuff. We even had a meeting this morning where we were discussing some of these things. And the desire for these folks to make decisions and get on with things is what really impresses me and gives me hope that we're going to meet some of the expectations you have for your university system in a way that's been better than we've been able to do it in the past. There's some gee whiz numbers here, but I think the one that I like is the next chart, the report card. Here's just a sample of some of the metrics that we're tracking. We've talked metrics before. We've got a lot of them now that we track. But you have given us in the past 2 years dollars for advising, and that has had a major difference in terms of retention, in terms of keeping students in, getting students through. And we're starting to see numbers with regard to our Stay on Track program, Take 15 Hours program, the Comprehensive Advising program. We're starting to see results in those green arrows. And we can talk about that some more. The new set of metrics that I think are going to be really interesting is the national agendas coming out of the White House. There is a social education national agenda that is about to be revealed to all of us. It's coming out in bits and pieces right now, but there are some major initiatives that the administration wants to move forward with in higher education. Now, whether those things need congressional approval and will make it through the gauntlet, I don't know. Those things that don't need congressional approval, I feel fully certain that we're going to see those come down through the Department of Education. We're going to be accountable in some way or another for a certain level of performance that will go along with other states across the nation, and we will have a set of metrics that will be given to us in addition to our own metrics that we're going to have to report on. And that's just over the horizon and probably, I would guess, would occur before we meet again next year. I don't think there are any challenges here that we haven't all talked about before that you would disagree with. The last thing here is what's really behind the cooperation that we're seeing with the chancellors and the provosts, is this commitment to improvement. It's more than just a commitment to improvement. It's we need to raise the bar with regard to our university system. If we're going to take a center stage in terms of Arctic research, Arctic policy in so many different areas, whether it be under the sea, whether it be research in fisheries, whether it be resource security, law of the sea issues off the North Cape of Alaska with melting ice, climate change and the social impact of climate change in the state of Alaska, the entire nation clearly and very rapidly is starting to shift a focus to Alaska that's making our phone ring with people that we've never talked to before. And they want to make national policy, and they don't have any expertise in all these different areas. And they want the university to be like a brokerage firm that brings national focus in here in the policymaking process, but uses our experts, and I'm not just talking about the university, but experts in Alaska to help them form that policy. Now, on the surface, that's really good news. How it actually turns out will be something to be seen, but we've never had people talking to us the way they're talking to us now from places like the White House Office of Science and Technology or the State Department asking us to sit down with them and produce experts that can help them build policy. We want to be, as a university system, right in the middle of that process and then engaged by not only the state but the national level in terms of what it is they think they want to do in Alaska. With so much federal land and so much federal offshore and the issues in the north, where does the university fit in all this? Well, we want to take center stage. If we're timid, if we back off, if we're indecisive, I guarantee you there will be top-line universities in the lower 48 who will rush in here and try to fill the gap. And that's something that we don't want them to do. So we want to raise our reputation that our niche is Arctic and circumpolar, and we've got a handle on that, and we're the go-to people first for those kinds of issues. That takes faculty, it takes great facilities, which we're building, and it takes students who are interested in a career in those areas looking at Alaska as the place to go first before they select some other university. To do that, we have to have a reputation that's worthy of that. What's interesting is the fact that we're just not well known, and we're finding that out, that in the lower 48, I mean, we're way off up there someplace, and we're really not well known. When people come in and talk to us, they see a really rich university in terms of its capability. We've got to put those two together. If we do that, we work another problem, and that is, how do we get more students into the University of Alaska? Because alternative sources of income is one of the things you've told us to look for. there's only so many of those. One of them is more students. The demographics in Alaska are telling us it isn't going to be Alaskan students, more Alaskan students coming out of high school, likely, or more Alaskan students turning 18 and graduating. The biggest take is going to be students who have not yet decided they want to go into higher education, getting them into our two-year program, one-year certificate, articulating them into the four-year program, but more importantly, keeping the ones we get in the program and helping them to be successful and stay the course, because the dropout rates are high, and we need to fix that. That's all part of shaping Alaska's future. That doesn't take extra money. It takes us doing things smarter and doing it across the system the same way. Standards, but not standardization, is one of the things we're talking about. We've got a lot on our plate with regard to those kinds of issues. The budget is important to that, but right now, as we go through this bathtub, as we're looking at resources being tight and being maybe even tighter in the operating side as well as the capital side, we're not going to depend on getting more and more incremental dollars each year to be able to accomplish everything I've been talking about. That simply won't work. It's got to be done another way. And that's what we're up to as we come before you today. Now, having said that, we do have a budget briefing to get to, and that'll take about 30 seconds, and I will happily turn it over to Michelle at this point.
As part of the budget building process, we do look at ways that we can reduce costs as well, and so this is just some of the examples that we've been looking at to reduce costs, and then also new ways of generating revenue, for example, commercialization. FY15 program request, I think the President Gamble hit on this earlier in the briefing. These are the focus areas with advising, increasing high school readiness, teacher education, health, workforce development, and then research. Also mentioned earlier, of the program request that was included in the Board of Regents budget, there's $90,000 that was included in the governor's budget, and this is for the UAS mining program that was part of last year's budget request, included in the budget, but it was one-time funding. So this just transfers it over into base funding, so the program will continue. This is just a summary of what's included in the governor's budget. So starting up at the top, the $14.9 million budget reduction, which represents about 4% of unrestricted general fund employee compensation. We at the time of the governor's budget, we did have three contracts under negotiation. So that's for the contracts that had already been approved and for the non-union staff. And you'll see in there, as was mentioned, it's split 50-50 with state appropriations and then with university receipts at the university covers. Moving down, facility maintenance and repair and new facility operating costs, one of the significant items in there in that $2.1 million is for the UAA sports arena that's going to be opening in the fall. Program request, as we mentioned, was the $90,000 for the mining and then the estimate of the additional TVET funding of $51,000. And so that's the summary of the operating budget. Moving over to the capital budget, President Gamble, did you want to talk about a few of the things in there?
Very briefly, there are really two issues in the capital budget that are worth talking about. One is it's year five of the deferred maintenance five-year commitment on the part of the governor to give us $37.5 million a year as part of a program he outlined 5 years ago, where he was putting $100 million back into deferred maintenance across the state. And as you can see, we got a pretty major share of that. That's made a huge difference. 4 years of that kind of money. If you look at what's going on all across the system in terms of construction, last summer there were things under construction everywhere. They fell in two categories. One of them was the expenditure of those deferred maintenance dollars on small projects, and some larger projects all across the system. This is the fifth year. It was a little less than 37.5 last year. It was reduced down to 30 at the end of the session last year. But nevertheless, this is the last year, and we really don't have in the capital program, we're not spending dollars on planning for future buildings or future large construction. It's not there. There's a wish list, of course, that each of the chancellors would love to give you, and it's probably $500 million in total. But in terms of what we're spending planning money on and putting together in terms of our longer-term plans, what you see is about it. And the major construction that will be completed and the deferred maintenance money that has almost exclusively come from the governor's program will spend out. And when that's done, you will see a tremendous drop-off in the capital program. And it'll basically be trying to keep going with the things that we've already got built, renovating and upgrading, and then potentially a push to try to come in and see if we can get some help in purchasing specific kinds of high-tech equipment that go along with new engineering, things that the old engineering buildings just didn't have, but you need them now to accredit a really good engineering program. Our engineering program is doing well. I mean, our graduates are as many as we've ever had. There's quite a demand for them in Alaska. They're working all across the slope. And we've got two engineering buildings that are under construction that will cover the additional demand. But they're partially constructed, and then enter the problem with the UAF heat and power plant. And that's a huge $250 million problem. And really, it's going to be a square off, I think, between those two issues on the capital side. And if last year was any indication, this may go down late in the game before there's a resolution to determine exactly how we're going to proceed. I think you all have previously, some of you have had visits. You've gotten a lot of detail on the power plant upgrade. You're pretty well familiar with the engineering buildings and why you approved them before and why we're building those engineering buildings. But we've got a nexus here of both of these coming due, looking for money at the same point in time, at a time when the capital program is probably going to be very contentious. So I think this is going to be the hot issue for us in capital. We don't have really anything else in the capital program, and I'll leave it at that at this point.
So that's what's included in the governor's budget, the $37.5 million for deferred maintenance, and then $10 million of state appropriations for the engineering buildings, $10 million of receipt authority, and then $20 million of general receipt authority for capital projects. The final part of the presentation, we've included a few of the graphs that I think the committee has seen from some of the other departments, from legislative finance. This just shows over time the percent of general fund only of the University of Alaska compared to the total percent of all the agency budgets. So over time, you can see that percentage has been declining for general fund for the University of Alaska, and then also for unrestricted general fund as well. Over time, that percent has declined over time. This just shows the funding mix for the University of Alaska, our budget, the major funding sources you can see on here, federal receipts, other state funds, the designated general funds, and then the university receipts, with federal receipts making up about 16% of our total budget, then other state funds 9%, designated general funds, which a big portion of that is tuition, is about 34%, and then all the unrestricted general funds, that's a total of 40% of the total budget. And then this is just a summary of the 10-year fiscal plan, and you can see as part of our plan, we are looking, the average growth in the past had been about 3.4% of GF only, and we're looking at over time looking to decrease that rate of growth over time for general fund, and then the next graph for all funds as well. That's been about a 2.8% growth, and then as part of our 10-year plan, we're also looking to reduce that percentage growth into the future.
And with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, we are completing our briefing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And I'll start it out, I guess. I barely graduated from high school, so I have a hard time sometimes relating to some of the stuff I look at when it comes to education. And I see the university sitting up here, and I see K through 12 sitting down here, and then somewhere in between we have the Volk Ed portions that sometimes are kind of neglected. And it seems to me, and you've mentioned it a couple different times, both in my office and here, in reference to getting more students into the university, retention through graduation, and it's been a problem. And so is there a disconnect between our whole educational system that creates this problem of, the governor brought forward his plan a couple years ago to pay people to go to school, to higher education, so that they would get more students into the university and get students that would graduate. And so is there still a disconnect? That it seems to me there is, but I'm just a layman sitting out here trying to figure it out.
No, there actually is, and it's a national level issue. It's one that's being debated very hotly right now, and that is with the sophistication of what it takes to get into the workforce today and the earnings that are available for someone who goes into the workforce and gets a good job. The argument is, why do I want to go to college and pick up a 2 or 4 year degree when I can go right into the workforce and make money, and I come out of college in 4 years and I actually owe money, and then it takes me this long to break even? And they're looking at that analysis, and that's going on right here in Alaska too, particularly because we actually have some of the best paying jobs anywhere in the country. So that's a very legitimate issue, but there's a companion, two companions actually. One is the other national and very much an issue here in Alaska is that graduation from high school doesn't mean readiness for college. And that's a disconnect. That's a big disconnect, and one that we've begun to try to work with the K through 12 organization, through the state school board, through the Commissioner of Education, and we're meeting with them, we're talking with them, we're sharing ideas, and we're coming, I think, up with some interesting ways forward, where the focus is on the readiness piece, not on graduation. I mean, obviously, a high school has a mission to graduate its students, but those students need to be ready for the first major decision in their life. They either are ready to go into, let's say, an apprentice program in the workforce, which has significant demands if you're going into mining or if you're going into other technical areas, or they're ready to take the first step into higher education, in which case their placement is tested, and they're not. They're not ready. And so how do we make them ready? That's something in Alaska that we definitely have to work on. The folks who are not ready to go into the workforce, we do workforce training. We do it very well. We can expand workforce training. And if we're going to build dams, and if we're going to build pipelines, and if we're going to build new mines, and if we're going to do all those things, those are high-paying jobs, and they require thousands of workers. And we're looking at trying to be the significant source of those workers to take Alaskans to do those jobs. The high schools and the process of workforce development in the university is the only way we can prepare those workers, men and women, to be ready for those jobs. And right now, I would say our concern is we're not in a position to make enough of our people ready to be able to do that. And so we got to work that problem well ahead. We've still got time. We're lead time away, more than lead time away, probably. But we have to take that on, because your concern is exactly right.
All right, we'll go ahead and take questions from the committee members. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And I suppose we've all received visits from students, and the students that came to my office, I thought, were really well prepared. So. I appreciate you bringing the students down with you. and appreciate you all being here. I know one of the problems the university has had, I mean, you have students who range from the highest achieving to all across the spectrum at the university. And one of the problems I know you faced, and we're not going to change schools by next semester, so K through 12 by next semester. I know one of the problems you've had is in graduating students. And I noticed in the Board of Regents request there were a number of components for student advising. Are those aimed at helping students complete their curriculum and graduate, or are those something else, those components?
The former. That's exactly what it's for. We call it comprehensive advising because the research has determined that students leave for a whole number of reasons that go beyond just academic advising. You started giving us the money 2 years ago for this comprehensive advising, and we've been able to stretch those dollars to cover almost the entire system. The ask for this year would have completed that program, and we're already seeing the retention improvement and graduation improvement, particularly in, you know, the one-year program certification. The area where we need the most help is in our two-year programs. Completion rates are really low in two-year programs. That's where a lot of the workforce is going to come from in a sophisticated workforce environment like we have in Alaska. And what we're finding out is that people don't just all leave because they can't hack the academic program. They leave for a number of reasons that we never knew about before because we didn't really have the capacity to talk to all those students or to have a computer database that would allow us to bring their records from high school forward so that we can better understand who we're getting and work with them more on an individual basis, that longitudinal database, which is getting more and more common among other states, and we need it here too. So, yes, it's what we call a very comprehensive advising. You know, if a student I like to tell the story about the Alaska Native student who came in, was almost an A student first semester, was an A student the second semester. The computer program at UAA picked up a couple of comments that he had made to his record. And you can actually talk to your record through the kind of system that we're building with this money that you gave us. You know, it's an advisor has to handle a large number of students. And so the advisor picks up the phone and calls the student and says, what do you mean you're not coming back to school next year? Do you realize you're one of our best students? He's an engineering student. He says, my dad got laid off and I don't think I can afford, so I'm not going to come back to school next year. Well, in the past, we never would have known about that. He just wouldn't have shown up. When we heard about that, UAA said, do you have any idea how many scholarships you're eligible for? And when they laid that out there, solved the problem, and we kept the student. Now, that's just one example of what comprehensive advising is all about. It gets personal.
Representative Gere.
Thank you, the Chair. And you said that in the places where you've done this, I don't know if that means in the locations you've done this, and there are still some locations you haven't done it. Is that it? There are some locations you still haven't done it?
Right.
And in the locations you've done it, has comprehensive student advising been around long enough that you can give us any numbers in terms of graduation rates, or it's just too early to give us numbers like that?
Yes, I could give you some numbers, but I wouldn't bet the farm on them because it's a little early to claim victory. However, something's happening and happening more rapidly than we were used to year to year to year. And the consensus is that at the national level, we know the data says it works. That's why we asked for the money in the first place, because it had a high payoff. And we think we're starting to see the leading edge of the same kind of payoff here. I can give you some numbers, but I would be unscientific to claim that I could connect the two, cause and effect. But I'm thinking that's what it is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going by the numbers on page 8. So if I add all the numbers together, I get the university brings in about $913 million. How does that compare to how many graduates you have per year?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Representative Wilson.
Okay, so if I look at page 8 and I total up in FY15 your federal, other state designated and unrestricted money, it comes out to $912,791,000 approximately.
Slide 22, right? This one?
Well, mine says, 22, I'm sorry. It's 8 of 13 of a different one, sorry, on the other side. It's got two numbers, sorry. So I'm just taking the amount of money that has been allocated to the university, and what we've been talking for K-12 is looking more at outcomes. And for the university, mostly outcomes is how many graduate, whether that's with a two-year degree or a four-year degree. So if I'm looking at the total of that number based on how many graduates that you have, I'm just trying to make a comparison of how much is costing us in the state of Alaska to have someone graduate.
It costs us more than it does in the lower 48, and it costs us significantly more in the two-year programs than it does in the lower 48, because our two-year programs, tuition is the same as the four-year program, whereas the community colleges in the lower 48 charge on the average, I would say, about half of what we do. That was a decision made when we created the community colleges. Would I like to change that? Absolutely, because I think it'll make us more competitive, but I can't see my way to how to do that right now. The 61-62% of that cost, that total cost, is in terms of expenses, is going to be for paying benefits, obviously, and that's pretty consistent across the board for many education institutions. The one thing that we have that we probably do that other school systems don't do is we have a large fixed plan. We are the largest. We're the largest owners of facilities for the state of Alaska. We've got this, 6.7 million square feet of facilities all over the state, and paying the bills for maintaining each one of those locations and sites, while it offers the opportunity for higher education throughout our state, and that's the good side. The downside is that's an expensive proposition to keep up, because the buildings are old, the utilities are very expensive, you have overhead at each one of those sites, so on and so forth. If I look at the flagship campus of a system with, say, three schools, the difference between where their bills, where their expenses are, and where ours are, once you get past pay and benefits, are significantly different. So if you divide it out, if you simply do the math and divide it out, we are more expensive than our counterparts.
I guess what I'm trying to get to, Mr. Chair, we have over $1.4 billion that goes through K-12 for the formula, and then you add in almost another $1 billion to get, the university side of it. And I've heard for years now, we're not graduating students who are ready to go to the university, and every year I sit here and I hear we're going to start talking to K-12 and find out what the issues are. And until, I guess, we look at the outcomes, and maybe that's how we do it for K-12 as well as the university, on are we going to give so much money based on outcome versus just a figure that's out there. So that's what I'm trying to come up with is I heard $100,000 per student to get them at the cost of the university, not necessarily the student, and how do we measure those things. So it's not a criticism. I'm just trying to figure out dollar-wise how much is it, and then how do you come up with how long do we keep all the different types of majors you have trying to make it for everybody to be able to stay in Alaska, when in reality, as money gets short, that's not going to necessarily be possible.
Well, through the chair, it's absolutely going to be impossible. I mean, that's clear, and that's one of the issues in shaping Alaska's future is dealing with program review. Program review started to be an issue with this committee about 2 years ago, the first time I heard it. How do you determine how to keep a program or not keep a program? And we got deeper and deeper into it. Well, now the forcing function is we can't be all things to all people. And the determination of what is it we need to be for our workforce development and for our degree graduates, and then draw a box around that and say, that's us, and we don't want mission creep because we can't afford it. And the accelerated program review process is underway right now in great depth at all three universities. Programs have been dropped. Programs are being recommended to be either consolidated or dropped. And that process is going on right now. I would say that in terms of outcomes, on page 9, the report card, where you see baccalaureate engineering degrees going up and completion times going down, and those kinds of outputs are good indicators of the efficiency of the organization as well. So I would keep my eye on those. The accounting, the advising we just talked about has a part in that. Bachelor degree seekers completing 30 credits a year instead of going for 12 hours, you know, that's the six-year program. We're seeing more students buying into the 15-hour minimum. Those things have all been changes that have occurred just in the last two or three years. So I would keep my eye on those indicators as far as quality outputs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be easier, especially on the page that he just read, the President Gallant, page 9. If we had numbers versus percents, because it's up 12.1%, but it would help me to know we went from 1,000 students to 1,500 students. I don't know what those percents mean without numbers.
Thank you. Representative Costello.
Thank you. Recently I read a newspaper article which prompted me to call up Dr. Helena Wisnowski with the university, and I met with her and subsequently had a hearing about how you grow Alaska's economy, and she presented on the Seawolf Fund, and I find this, you know, fund very intriguing, how you take intellectual property and bring it to commercialization. Could you briefly tell the committee a bit about that fund and how you're working on efforts to bring commercialization to some of the ideas that come out of the university?
It's one thing to talk about things like innovation, and then it's another thing to actually do it. And this is an example of actually doing it. And the university, going back to my first association with it back in Mark Hamilton's day and back in the early 2000s, it wasn't necessarily a university-wide idea that the university should be involved in commercialization, in patents, and take it on as a university objective. There was a lot of disinterest, actually, at that point in time. Other universities had been very successful in this area, and there were some key people inside our university system who started talking again about why aren't we doing this. It was something that I believed in when I came in. In fact, I talked about it at the very beginning when I was being interviewed. And so we got to work right away on what was already being thought about, and both UAF and UAA each had an eagerness to want to pursue this with the support of the Board of Regents and the support of the President. And making it an objective. Both institutions have come up with what we would call offices of innovation that have the capacity to be able to commercialize intellectual property, either through patents or through the opportunity to get investors who would come in and actually provide the seed money to spin off a business where the university gets a share of the profits of that business. And the inventors also get a share. Those institutions, neither one of them had anything like this before. So there wasn't a mechanism for really developing intellectual property before. Now it's set up very nicely in both institutions. And we didn't include the charts, but if you look at the before and after in 1 year of the number of patent applications and inventions that have been forwarded through both those institutions, it's off the charts, and some of the inventions have the potential of being big, I mean real big. It's not going to pay all our bills. We've looked at the couple of universities who are probably really good at this, University of Wisconsin being one that I like to look at. But these spinoffs provide jobs. They provide additional revenue and tax base to the community. They do provide revenue to the university as well as to the individuals, and they provide an incentive for many more people to say, boy, if we can do this, let's do some more. And so it grows. It has a growth factor to it. And that's what we're hoping will happen. It will, if we're lucky, we can hit the big one like Google. But if not, what it will do is it will focus on the university, it will raise the reputation of the university, and it will be a highlight of what this university is capable of doing for the state of Alaska. 3 or 4 years ago, I mean, it was virtually zero. I mean, you can't see the graph, but you can hardly see the blip where it registered. And then in 1 year, number of invention disclosures, this was UAF, in 1 year they went from, I can't even read the number, it's so small, it was 6. They went to 41. The next year they went to 86. And that'll level off at some point. But I think it's an indicator that there's a lot of potential there, and we absolutely support it.
Well, kudos to you for hiring Dr. Wisniewski. And I know I'm pronouncing her name wrong, but I think people like that, and the we all know that innovation is the number one way to grow an economy. And I think for us to look to the university as an economic engine is something that I personally would like to see us do. And I would encourage you to grow those innovators and young people who want to provide inventions that make life in Alaska better in terms of across all of our sectors. And thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3 or 4 sessions ago, we had the three chancellors here then, Rogers, Pugh, and Ulmer, and members of the committee, and I think myself included, asked them about their charitable giving and private sector initiatives, non-government. And I think Chancellor Ulmer at UAA had a far better story to tell, and Chancellor Rogers, okay, but not quite as good. But UAS was really, I think Chancellor Pugh repeated several times, Department of Labor is one of their sources, Now, I just read in the paper, and it's been on the blogs, about a charitable contribution from UAS to another entity. Has UAS gotten, and please disabuse, if there's misinformation, things in the paper and on the internet if it wasn't university money, and this is a great chance to clear that up, are they in such solid footing now that they've turned around where they were 3 or 4 years ago that they're giving money instead of asking for it?
I'm generally familiar with the situation that you're talking about, not intimately familiar. I do know that this is a regular participation that they conduct. I think it's something they do annually. Resulted in $300,000 of charitable giving in terms of the overall event that they contributed to. And so the decision on the part of the university was this was a very worthy cause to contribute to in the community. And of course, they have community campuses, and the integration with the community and the universities is really pretty tight all over the state. So this was nothing out of the ordinary. From my perspective, it was entirely reasonable, and the fact that they earned so much out of that seemed to be make it a worthy cause. That's my initial observation.
The university earned so much, or that
the event that they contributed to earned the $300,000.
And better off because of the public contribution.
Yes.
Okay. Just I was asked to bring this up, and it was raised, and so we'll leave that one on the table now. And I had another question: the announcement, and I assume it was formulated by the Board of Regents about creating a more rigid entrance requirement for our campuses. I don't know if it was just one of the campuses or all three of the main campuses, and. Can you talk about that and how that'll affect, does that mean less remedial education costs? What's the impact? Or was a guy like me who maybe wasn't prepared, maybe might not even got into UAF? I mean, some of the impacts. I don't think there's been a lot of discussion about that after the announcement, and how fleshed out is that?
Well, that's a great question, because it's a good example of how when you're trying to be open and transparent in the deliberative process, sometimes a piece of information will get pulled out of that that's got some incendiary value to it, and it'll take off on its own. The increase
part of it is incendiary. I guess that's what I know.
Well, the fact that people will be left out of the ability to get into higher education. The real piece, the picture that we're looking at was, yes, there was a discussion about it would be a good idea to for degree programs where you enter into, choose a major and enter into a degree program, you have to meet a certain academic requirement to be allowed into the program, such as engineering. You can't take somebody who's unprepared, who you know is unprepared, put them into engineering where you know they're not going to make it through the first year. But the second piece to this is, our job is to take that person who's unprepared and put and place them in the system at the point at which they can succeed, and then move them to the point where they're ready to meet those requirements and enter into a four-year engineering program. In the past, we didn't concern ourselves necessarily so much about that. Now, we want to bring in as many people as we can into the system and try to put them where they want to go. So this is a marked difference than what we did before, and I've heard the same concern that we're going to cut people out of the opportunity, and it's just exactly the opposite. We're going to take the people who weren't ready and would have no chance of success, and we're going to bring them in, and we're going to say, you're not ready, but we're going to put you here, and we're going to get you ready, and then you're going to pass the ability to be accepted into the engineering program or the math program degree that they want to go into. So I think it's a healthy thing and a good idea. It doesn't have a downside to it.
I just back to the first part of the question: is there a committee that decides on charitables if there are folks on the MATSU who want to look to the university for make sure they get included in the fundraising circuit, and on the Anchorage campus, who do they call?
There are two routes. One is that normally the chancellor will be made aware through his advancement people at the chancellor level at a fairly low level. If it's a major or if it's a system-wide kind of thing, if it's a major contribution of something greater than that, our advancement office, Vice President for Advancement, would actually make that call as to whether or not it's in the best interest of the university to donate money to a program like the one you're talking about.
And I'm only asking that informational. I actually don't think we should have our entities and our quasi-government corporations, whether it's the railroad, whether it's the ADA board, sponsoring and buying expensive tables at galas and things like that. I think it's a bad policy. But I'm just really kind of trying to ferret out how widespread. So it is, I guess it's at any campus, and I guess whether it could be some of our larger corporations who are trying to buy goodwill to lobby against us sometimes, the appropriators, or to advocate for a position. I wonder sometimes why the seafood marketing, which I sat on for 8 years, bought a lot of expensive participations into events. It's just, I think we need to examine that whole policy, and I'm not trying to bring up a contentious issue, but it's when we're talking about making decisions, we should look at all these things, and it's often its appearance more than it is a large substance of money, but everything's a real dollar.
Mr. Chair, optics counts, and I agree with you. And I've personally been involved in saying no to some of those. But if it's under the circumstances, the sense of the committee that this is something that we need to restrain ourselves on, particularly now, I'll be happy to look into that personally.
Perhaps might have been more appropriate for the foundation to look at that because it's private sources. And that's just troubles me when I see folks at an event that I I decide with my own dollars and on my salary level, and I see employees of a lot of our entities are at the same event I just bought an expensive ticket to show my support for a charity. You're correct, the optics issue.
And the foundation really is the appropriate venue and does most of that. We'll take a look at that, and I'll convey that sense of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to bog down on a $5,000 item when we're talking about $1 billion, and that's what we do regularly here, though. Thank you.
On that point, can I make a...
On that point, then we've got to move on.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the point that's being raised and share your concerns with privately funded events, but this was a fundraiser for a publicly and privately funded institution that will be primarily involved in native language preservation and cultural heritage. And just for your information, this committee did approve two separate appropriations to the same project. Thank you.
All right, with that, you will take the rest of the conversation up with the subcommittee on the budget and go from there. Appreciate your testimony today and the discussion we've had. Thank you very much to the students who attended, and look to see you attend a little bit more and get a little bit better in what we really do down here.
If I might say, we did not bring the students with us. They're a very independent group and part of the governance process of the university, and they made the decision to come down here and visit with you all, and of course we support that, obviously. And
more power to them. Thank you. So we're going to take a very brief at ease while we change the chairs here and bring up the Department of Administration.
Thank you.
Hey, Kathy. That was
All right, we reconvene the Finance Committee, and now we will hear from the Department of Administration and their overview of the budget. Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and with me is Mike Barnhill, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Department, and Sherry Lowenstein, who is our Admin Services Director, and will be serving as Vanna White today. Our slide presentation. First and foremost with the department, the mission of the Department of Administration is to provide consistent and efficient support services to state agencies so they better serve Alaskans. Our core services are legal, Advocacy and Regulatory Services, Family Support, and Enterprise Support Services. Our org chart is pretty straightforward. We have two deputy commissioners, one is currently vacant, two special assistants, and we have 10 divisions and 5 commissions. We've broken it up between what serves the public in green versus what serves state agencies. And we're a very diverse one, anywhere from the Division of Motor Vehicles to General Services to Public Defenders. So we're across the board in our spectrum. Across the state, we have offices throughout the state, primarily with DMV and the Public Defender's Office, but anywhere from Unalaska to Barrow to Ketchikan. As far as our performance measures, one of our target measures was with DMV customer service, and that was that we try to have our customer service within 20 minutes of arriving, and our performance data shows that we are hitting that at 71%. The one thing to take note is we have 31 offices across the state, of which previously we were only recording in 16 of them, and now we're recording in all 31 offices. And so this year is probably a little bit more accurate than previous years. One of our second one is our public defender agency cost per criminal case, and what it costs to represent a client, whether it be a misdemeanor or a B or C felony or unclassified felonies. As you can see, those costs are continuing to grow. It's something that we work very closely with. Mike does, especially with public defenders, to try to keep that cost down, but it is something that is continuing to grow slightly, but it does grow. Another one issue is family support, and that is public wards with shelter available to them. And it is something that we strive for with OPA, and that right now in fiscal year 2013, less than 1% of the public guardian clients did not have shelter, and that was sometimes in smaller communities. But that's a goal that we've continued to hit. We hit 100% last year and 99%. 2012, we hit 100% and 99% in 2013. Another one of our targets is the average personnel services cost per child in need. And with that scenario, that has continued to grow as we try to hold down those costs, but it is a very important service. But we do want to bring to the attention of the committee that it has grown since last year. A new slide, and it's kind of hard to read on the graph because of the way the percentages were. But we began measuring our budget growth trend in 2009, reporting the first time in 2013. As you can see, the cost growth trend was 4.3. We've been able to bend the curve slightly downward with a cost growth trend of 3.66. And our current overall annual increase for our FY14 management plan to FY15 governor budget is 1.7. So we understand the need to hold down cost and are trying to do that and trying to measure that performance in outlying years. Our customer satisfaction. This is where we measure the services that we provide, whether that be through our ETS, our Enterprise Technology, Division of Finance, General Services, or Risk Management. And with that, we have a satisfaction rate. It was slightly dipped last year to 76.6, and the next slide will represent kind of where we are across the board, whether it be the Division of Finance, it's the Division of General Services, Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, Enterprise Technologies, and Division of Risk Management. A lot of those do fluctuate depending on what we're doing. And what I mean by that is whether we do space standards, that affects DGSs. Whether we do labor contracts and some of the services we provide, like when we decentralize HR functions, that also affects this survey. But for the most part, we're maintaining and we're trying to track, and we're having these conversations when we reach out to the ASDs, the other admin service directors of other departments, to help measure where we are. This slide from the share total agency operations, it represents the department's general fund compared to statewide totals. While there is a large jump, it represents less than a quarter of a percent change. The department is at 2.2 in FY15 or 0.01 higher than we were in FY2006. The department GF is approximately one-third of our total budget. OPA, Office of Public Advocacy, and PD have the largest proportion of the unrestricted general funds, followed by finance, ETS, primarily SATs and LMR, and public broadcasting. And DMV has the largest portion of restricted general fund with $16,429,000, and Alaska Oil and Gas Commission is the next with 7.2. Being a service provider, our largest expense is contractual line. The second highest is the personal services line in this graph. The DOA shows an annual increase of the total budget by a line item, and the total budget for this year, or FY14, is about $343 million for the department. Compared to the last slide, most of these line items are paid for with other funds. The other funds consist of DBR, Division of Retirement and Benefits, trust funds, ISF, and interagency, which mainly are DGS, Division of General Services. The bulk of the unrestricted general fund is to Office of Public Advocacy and Public Defenders, and next is Division of Finance. There is a general fund in the variety of components. The bulk of the designated general funds is DMV. And any federal funding that we do receive is a very small portion of our budget, primarily Office of Public Advocacy, Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, and DMV, with the Victims Compensation Board. Our continued budget growth compared to the 10-year plan. The chart highlights the growth of all funds in our budget. The 10-year plan does not include personal services growth. The growth of our budget since 2005 has an average 4.7% compared to 5.5 on the chart of last year. In summary, the chart highlights our continuing challenges to reduce our rate of growth to something more sustainable, and we have made headway in reducing the growth of the department. The chart on the next slide is the growth of the general fund proportion of our budget. The growth of our budget since 2005 has averaged 5.6 compared to 7.3 on the graph from last year. In the past, our general fund supported divisions have grown faster overall than the rest of our department. The costs have somewhat been contained, and we continue to strive to blend our cost curve. I think it is important to note, though, the largest two general fund supported agencies are the Office of Public Advocacy and the Public Defenders, and they have had significant annual budget increases that have driven up the overline cost. And since 2006, the department has added approximately 80 new PCNs, of which 69 were for open PD. So when you look that we've grown our number of our employees by 80 in the last 8 years, only 11 of those were for eight divisions. Two of those are 69, represent 69 of them. Something that is always fun to talk about, and that's the focus on cost avoidance. One of the issues that we are continuing to do, and that's labor contracts. We are currently this year negotiating 5 labor contracts. Public safety, which I would be pleased to report, I think we're close. We've talked monetary terms. I don't think that we're too far apart. And I would hope that maybe we can have something to you this month. As far as the other 4, we have one with AVTAC, with the Votech School. That is going very well. With the Marine unions, we are continuing to be challenged by them with some of their proposals. We're still in negotiations, but one of them, once we do the cost estimate, they're asking for a 30% increase. So we're working on bringing some reality to what they can expect. Another issue is healthcare spend, and that is to reduce the rate of our healthcare costs, reduction of the unfunded liability, which is lowering future costs, utilization of our space, the better use of our space. The state, you know, we lease out over 5 million, or we own or lease 5 million square feet of office space across the state, of which we have not necessarily been the best stewards to make sure that the space is what was needed. And we've done space standards within the Atwood building, and we are seeing potential savings there. In one case, in one agency, if they fully implement space standards, they would save over $1 million to their operating budget. So we are in conversations of how they can do that. And then another one is the procurement savings, and that is lowering the cost to what we already purchase. When we talk about our employees, and these are placed in the order in which we're negotiating. So you can see with AVTAC, IBU, Inman Boatman's Union, MEBA, our Master Mates and Pilots in Public Safety. What their average salary is for those employees, we pay very well. And when you also have to add about 49% on top of that is the current benefit package. To put it a little bit in comparison, we're negotiating $100 million worth of payroll in these five contracts. One thing, though, I would like to point out is when we look at the Inman Boatman's Union of the Pacific, 10% of their membership reside out of state, 90% live in Alaska. When you look at MEBA, the Marine Engineers, they have 38% of their membership live outside the state of Alaska. And when we look at our master mates and pilots on our vessels, almost 20% of that membership lives out of state. And so one thing we have is when we are in negotiations, I do think where the members live kind of jade maybe a little bit of our negotiations. Where some of our difficulty is coming from is having some of these unions realize the budget situation that the state faces and the actual cost of the marine highway system to operate. The next slide is the benefits, and this is for health care. As you can see with the red bar, the state this is what the state contributes to the active employees, or we make contributions to union trust, which is a flatline benefit credit of $1,389. As you can see, the cost of our health care continues to go up, along with and our contributions remain flat with the $1,389. We are only one of seven states that fully fund employee premiums for family coverage. So in the realm of looking at benefits, we have one of the more generous packages in the country for our employees. We're looking at strategies to reduce the rate and the cost of growth. That is through the implementation of an employee wellness program, improved consumerism, and appropriate utilization of services by our members so they have a better idea of what it costs. And then plan design changes to support those, along with contracting strategies, and also we've procured, which we'll talk about in a minute, a new third-party administrator for our health plan, Aetna. And with that, kind of put it in perspective, in FY13, our claims cost was $600 million to the state of Alaska. When we went out to look for a new third-party administrator, because the contract terms were up for AlaskaCare, there was an RFP put together, and one of the focus points was to go out and with the $600 million, and what would that cost be in their network? And Aetna has come back, and they believe that they could have been a potential savings of $50 million. So in previous contract, we had always looked at what the cost was for the third-party administrator. That's where our decision-maker was as who it went out. This year with Mike and his team, they did an excellent job, went out and said, reprice this. And when you see a $50 million savings, and that's part of our RFP process, it was huge. Aetna was the clear winner, and this was the first time, I think ever, we went out with a contract worth approximately $100 million, and there was no protest. And that's huge for Mike and the work that he did. They cut the RFP into four major components. Three were awarded to Aetna and one to Moda, which was for dental. We introduced a new dental network. The first time in 10 years and 14 years, respectively, we revised the plan booklets for active employees and for retirees, and we actually have those plan booklets out on the Internet taking comments from our employees, from our retirees, on their plan booklets. And we also have with Aetna, which we've had an extremely large call volume this month with any type of change, but we've had over 50,000 calls. And through various call centers, Aetna has a concierge service where our members can usually get through to somebody within a few minutes. and any issues that we've been able to have or we've had with some problems or people actually waiting literally at the doctor's office with an issue with it, they've been able to resolve while they're standing there. We've been extremely impressed with that and their attention to this contract. And, of course, our goal is the high-quality health care at sustainable and a reasonable cost. We could probably go through this very quickly, not thinking you guys want to take a lot of time on this particular slide. But one thing that is obviously a concern for us as we look at retirement and benefits is the fact that we look like we will be paying $140 billion in benefit payments over the next 70 years. As you can see, we're at the beginning of a huge wave of retirements, and this will challenge us. This will challenge us operationally and poses ongoing challenges. We are, from an operational standpoint, the Division of Retirement Benefits is undertaking a reorganization to free up capacity so we can accomplish the added work. And the cost of the pensions and health care for these retirees are reflected in the personal services line. And the unfunded liability, the current person insurance account balance is $19.9 billion. It is not 16.8, but of course the markets have been down this month. Unfunded liability is approximately $11.9 billion at this time. Again, we'll slip through this, but on this particular graph, it shows what the payment under label percent pay would be. The payments would gradually grow as payment grows to over $1 billion by 2026, and which we'll have a lot further discussion on, and that is the governor's proposal that would reduce the overall liability in FY15 and then outlying years would be capped at $500 million, and this is through FY2035, and this provides the stability and the certainty for the general fund budgeting purposes. The next one, just to quickly touch on it, it's an initiative we've had for less than a year now, right at a year now, and that's the Universal State Space Standards. We believe that we say $125 million, but our analysis right now is closer to $137 million over the next 20 years in reduced lease cost. We've done that through working with the Western states on a contract on systems furniture that's actually being implemented through Capital, a local vendor. The new space is something where we create neighborhoods. We've been removing walls and private offices, allowing for more natural light, also encouraging the shared printers, scanners, and copiers. And one thing that's kind of been an issue is a clean desk policy. We've had some employees not like the idea of a clean desk policy. And what we mean by that is the fact is if you have confidential data on your desk at the end of the day, you put it away. You lock it up in a cabinet. You turn off your computer. And basically the way that I've summed it up with a couple employees is if you want your home address and your Social Security number left on somebody's desk, that's what we're trying to avoid, is to put that stuff away, lock it up, and secure it. That's our version of a clean desk. I think a lot of them, you see piles, and hopefully through peer pressure they reduce and their supervisor reduce those piles, but we're concerned about the confidentiality of information. This slide just shows what a hallway looked like before actually up in Department of Corrections and after Space Standards where it was opened up. Department of Corrections, I think, is a good example. In the footprint that they basically had in the Atwood, they had space on the 6th floor, the 12th floor, and the 18th floor, and through the space consolidation, they consolidated those all onto the 18th floor and plus got rid of a private lease in the private sector, and they're all on the same floor. I think many of you have toured, and we're welcome any tours here in Juneau. We have over in the State House building where we've done it, or in Anchorage, we'll give tours and kind of show. And one thing is, I think a lot of employees were apprehensive at first, and now if you talk to some of my fellow commissioners, they have more employees wanting to sign up for Space Standards because it's an improvement of their work environment than actually they probably have funding for, or the time, or for actually for us time to do within the next short duration. I say next couple of years. If you want to, next slide. This I think this is, you know, the state has always had space standards. You can look at the slide from the top. That was the state office building here in Juneau in the mid-70s, and the slides at the bottom are what the Division of General Services look like today. So space standards has had a tremendous difference with our employees. When we talked about purchasing, and that's purchasing of commodities that we already have, and that is the Division of General Services, they have total realized savings in FY13 of about $56 million. And this is reducing what we already purchase. And we do that through contracts with Western States for computers. We do it with office supplies versus what we could get at a contractor rate, but by doing multi-state, what that multi-state rate would be, with savings for travel, software. We just recently completed a large RFP for heating diesel, unleaded fuel, and that for DOT and our different divisions within, which is $5 million. And then the systems furniture alone, from what we were spending in the past with the new contract, it's a saving $2.7 million a year. And this is a continuing thing that the Division of General Services strives to provide every year, is where they can maximize known quantities of purchases and where they can get the best savings. For this year's budget, we do have operating increments. I can walk through them if you want, or we can just however you would like that, Mr. Chair.
I think they can be taken up at subcommittee.
Okay. I will just say one thing with this particular year with operating increments. I know any increase is going to be frowned upon, and we understand that. Hopefully we've identified small increases where they do make a difference in how we operate. And so we will discuss more of that at our subcommittee level. Same thing with deferred maintenance and capital requests. When we started this budget process internally, we had $80 million worth of requests. What we have put forward is about $10 million in requests. And we can talk again about that at subcommittee. A lot of it is deferred maintenance on our buildings and also our SATs deferred maintenance, where we're concluding 5 years of 5 years. Other issues that we just kind of wanted to throw out is the bargaining unit with negotiations. I think I've hit on that. I hope that maybe I can provide some time to give the committee an update on our on where our focus is, what some of our concerns are with our marine contracts. And then with legal advocacy and appropriation, one thing to recognize is as there's change to plea policy like there was with Department of Law, that does affect us because how they do that affects public defenders and Office of Public Advocacy. So there is a check and balance there. One thing, too, is we're doing our IRIS transition, which is Integrated Resource Information System. It was funded by the legislature to the tune of $80 million. It is a replacement of our statewide administrative systems, accounting, payroll, and a new procurement system. And that project is actually being headed up with Scott Earhart, who's doing a fantastic job for us. And it is scheduled to go live July 1st of 2015. And so we will meet that target, and it is on budget. And we see no issues with that. A couple of other issues that we have with Enterprise Technology Services, or IT, is we are continuing to look at our bandwidth concerns in rural Alaska. Security, to look at the department gap analysis of where our security office is and what type of security with the other departments. We're always looking for a mobile device strategy and support as we mushroom with a lot of our personal devices and getting a strategy around that and the cost. We're continuing to work with identity management, which is the My Alaska component, and we are working with the enhanced base rate setting and rate setting alignment with the budget process, which is always been difficult with IT services just because of the amount of stuff that they do manage, and we always want to make sure we get our rates in early prior to the budget making process. Another thing that we've been working with IT on, and that is they have a state-of-the-art cloud facility. in Anchorage on off Raspberry in the GCI facility that we currently lease out, and we've been working with other agencies. Rather than replace servers and items and put them back into closets and other areas in state government, let's put them out in a state-of-the-art facility where there is the backup, they have the redundancy, there is the security, and hopefully the lowering of costs, because we won't have all these mini data centers. We'll have one primarily, one in Anchorage, as well as the one that we currently have in Juneau. And with that, which was very quick, but thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thayer, for a number of years, I would quote the number that we had 2,000 foster youth in our system, and the OCS director came to me about 4 years ago, and, you know, we've got that down to 1,600, and I was really excited. But it's back at 2,000 foster youth. In your department, the Office of Public Advocacy employs guardian ad litems to represent the interests of these children, figure out their needs, helps make sure they don't bounce between schools, things like that. As the number of foster youth have grown back again, unfortunately, has the number of guardian ad litems kept pace? I've heard from inside the system that the guardian ad litems that you have are overstressed.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think Mr. Barnhill might be able to answer that one.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I didn't come today with specific data on caseloads by guardian ad litem. I'm happy to bring that back to you through the chair. But one of the primary ways, I think you know, that the Office of Public Advocacy has managed caseload growth in the past is through the CASA program, where we get volunteers to come in and serve as guardians ad litem. Rick Allen, our director of the Office of Public Advocacy, has been just a staunch supporter of the CASA program and trying to get additional volunteers in throughout the state, including entering into memoranda of agreement with tribal organizations to provide training and participation so that we can boost that CASA program. So that's what I have to offer today. I really support the idea of utilizing volunteers wherever we can to deal with some of these volatile caseloads. We'll come back to you with the specific data as of right now.
Through the chair. I guess it's going to be hard for me to find out. I'm a complete supporter of the CASA program, as you might expect. But I have heard that the guardian ad litems, even with the CASAs who are there, are overstressed. And so to the extent I can get a true answer as to whether or not that's accurate or not, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. I think through the chair, Representative Guerra, this is stressful work. I mean, there's no question. Is it more stressful right now than it was 2 years ago? I don't have an answer for you.
Okay. And then just whether or not the numbers of guardian ad litems.
Yeah, we can get that information.
Ratio between them and the number of foster youth or their caseloads. Yeah.
Representative Edgar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that I appreciate under the other issues page the reference to broadband access in rural Alaska, because it's on some days I'm remembering a call I got this fall from a state employee in Dillingham describing how the circle spins as you send an email out. That was 20 minutes and the basic email still hadn't been able to go out, so it is a big issue out there, and it is of course related to productivity and things like that. And so to the extent that I can commend you for having it rise to the level that it is, and encourage you to continue to focus on it, I would definitely do that, because it's not only difficult to get your job done out there, but it's also, if you want to be a hardworking employee, it certainly doesn't help you get your job done.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we'll bring by your office, because we keep stats on a regular basis on all of our data connections and bandwidth across the state. And Dillingham in particular has been one we've been watching, because that one has been extremely slow. We've tried to optimize it. It's had some effect where we realize in some of our areas where they were accessing programs that were based in Anchorage, and so it was going both ways. And so now we've put the programs actually on some in rural Alaska, so it's slowing down and we're having quicker bandwidth. So it's an ongoing challenge, but I do have some data I think you'll find useful to kind of see the cost and the speed that we have.
Oh, thank you. Commissioner, I think you have a really tough job, but I'm glad you're doing it because I actually think you and your team are doing a really good job in trying to find, through innovation and other methods, ways to run government more efficiently. So I want to commend you for that. I do want to note, however, that the room emptied when you came in, but I don't think that that necessarily is indicative of how important your department is and how it undercuts so many of the things that we do in state government. And one thing that I wanted to ask about is with the customer service survey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you do that, and is it something you think other departments could easily employ, especially those that deal with the public on a regular basis?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, first of all, thank you. I just assumed everybody thought the department was well run, and that's why they left. and I do want to say Becky Holberg left the department in very well, and so stepping into her shoes will be difficult, but it's a well-oiled machine. As far as the surveys, I think we can employ that with others. It's something we do with our ASDs. It's actually something we've actually surveyed when we look at space standards. Once somebody has been in the new space for 69 days, we do survey the employees to find out what do they like about it, what they don't like about it, what changes would they would make. And so we're very big on trying to survey our customers to find out what we're doing. We mainly use SurveyMonkey as a tool. And
that's right. Through the chair, we use SurveyMonkey. Our special assistant, Mr. Andy Mills, is sitting behind us, who's a wizard at doing these kind of things. And this particular survey was just four or five simple questions to our primary department contacts, the administrative services directors of each department got this, and then we asked them to turn it around and tell us what they think. And for any service-based organization, it's really important to touch base with your customers on a fairly regular basis to find out what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, what can we do better.
I think it's a great idea, and I was wondering if you're open to lending Andy out to other departments then.
You have the right to remain silent.
Through the chair, on the advice of counsel, he might be available to help others learn the process, but not to be lent out.
All right, any further questions, Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. More of a comment than a question. Of course, I thought they all left because they knew that the department was in such good hands with the budget chair. But I just wanted to follow up on particularly on Representative Edgman's question, let him know that actually next Thursday morning we have an entire day's committee hearing on the issue of broadband and related issues. So we've both the commissioner and I have heard the comments around this table over the last couple of weeks, and it will be taken up in great depth at the subcommittee process.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make my apologies for missing the presentation. We just got news that Flint Hills Refinery is closing down, 81 jobs lost. Another hit to the interior due to energy and some DEC regulations, so I will catch up with Representative Holmes on this or whatever, but please keep them in your thoughts. This is a pretty big hit to our community.
Further questions, comments? Seeing none, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony and have fun in subcommittee. All right, with that, that's the last item we have for today's agenda. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the 5th of February at 1:30, we will again, take up some overviews with the governor's, Department of Education and then the Department of Commerce and Economic. With that, we are adjourned for the day.